Morning, everyone. Kind of our impromptu service today. It's lovely. And a beautiful day out for it, too. Will you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 3, Verse 11. Krishna speaking, with this yajna, or practice, meditate on the divas, and may these divas think of thee, thus communing one with another, thou shalt receive the supreme good. Master's Commentary. With the true inner fire rite performed in yoga meditation, become attuned to the divas, literally the shining ones, the astral forces, angels, divine souls, who, as God's cosmic agents, are instrumental in the governing of the worlds. To those in harmony with the exacting laws of nature, the divas respond favorably. Thus, continuing in this manner of attunement, thou wilt become eligible to unite with the formless spirit, creator of astral deities, who supervise the workings of this ordered universe. Among the customs of all ancient peoples were nature rites, whose purpose was to acknowledge man's dependence on the natural forces and bounty of his environment. Instinctively, they recognized the debt and reverence owed to the higher intelligence working within the circumambient wonders. It is no wonder that the godlessness prevalent in the modern age has spawned a civilization out of touch with the beneficence of nature. The God-given role of guardianship of the earth did not confer on man absolute sovereignty. His wanton domination is destructive of the very conditions necessary for his existence. The universal structure and man's infinitesimal place in it are made possible only by the working together in precise harmony of an awesome combination of intelligent cosmic forces guided by a supreme creator. Man would do well to put himself in attunement with these. For modern man to hold that the mathematical perfection of the universe could come about by chance is nothing but an expression of man's egotism, a loathing to concede that there could be something greater than he from which he only borrows his powers and intelligence and to which he owes his humble allegiance and worship. The Hindu masters of ancient times knew the art of worshipping with special fire ceremonies and vibratory chants by which they could invoke the manifestation of the angels of God. Correspondingly, a literal interpretation of this stanza is that, through fire oblations and chants, properly performed, one should invoke and pay homage to the astral deities, superior to man in the order of evolution, who, through the divine laws of nature, carry on the cosmic functions. Thus, man will create good karma that will free his life from the hazards of sudden fruition of the effects from unseen evil causes set in motion by him in the past. Materially minded people live their days by the sweat of their brows. Like a mule that carries a huge bag of gold, this treasure is not only of no use to the mule through the animal's ignorance, but is the cause of its active suffering from the burden of the weight. Worldly men, like dumb animal, carry a heavy burden of material duties, suffering and fearing, but reaping little benefit from the onerous labors. Isn't that a wonderful description? Materially minded people live their days by the sweat of their brows, like a mule that carries a huge bag of gold. This treasure is not only of no use to the mule through the animal's ignorance, but is of the cause of its active suffering from the burden of the weight. Worldly men, like the dumb animal, carry a heavy burden of material duties, suffering and fearing, but reaping little benefit from the onerous labors. They only eat, sleep, earn, and procreate, giving not a single truly reflective thought to God or to his spiritual government. When misfortunes visit such men, they call it ill luck or fate. When good fortune smiles on them, they say that it is good luck or chance. Few realize that their lives are governed by the effects of past actions, karma, and that they are subject to universal laws administered by higher forces. The Gita, therefore, points out, instead of leading an ignorant life, the average man should perform certain spiritual ceremonies, religious observances outlined by saints, to place oneself in harmony with high astral deities and unseen laws they govern, thus bringing about a conscious control of life's developments. This is very interesting, because what is being described here is for all mankind, in the sense that it takes into account that there are those individuals who live in complete and total ignorance that there's anything of a divine nature about life. It's interesting, in the local newspaper that takes, of course, its writings from national sources, that there's a religion section each Saturday in the paper. And I would say that perhaps one-third to one-quarter of the writings are about current-day atheists, and this in the religion section. You could say, well, perhaps it's a good place to have that discussion. But it's very interesting to me that there's these tremendous kind of effort and energy given by the atheists that are anti-religion. Now, we can look about and we can see what the faults of religion is, or what they are. And we can look at them with a cool eye of reason, and we can work through these kinds of problems that happen within religions. But there are people who feel hurt and injured and betrayed to their very basic core by what has happened within religious institutions. And then they ascribe this to an absent God because of the actions that have been taken by those institutions or individuals within those institutions and the harm that has come about thereby. And they say, well, if that's not true of a certain religion, then the whole thing must be a falsehood and a lie. They look upon this universe with incomprehending eyes. They don't see the mystery, the beauty, the loveliness that is beyond description, in a way that offers that there is a signature for a universal divine intelligence. There have been mathematical kinds of projections that have been created, or mathematical models that have been created, where the universe or God is absent, and they look at it and they say, what is the chance of a Big Bang erupting and then all of these things that have formed in terms of planets, solar systems, then you get down into the individual planet and how life is formed, and then the intricacy of life, how the trees, how the shrubs, how animals came from that, and then animals evolving, and then the chances, just pure chance, of all of that evolving into a human being, and the complexities of the human system, the heart, the liver, the blood flow, everything that is required in order to become a human being. And so these mathematicians have set out to say, all right, just by realm of chance, what would it take for that to happen? And just for the human structure itself, after the Earth has evolved in the way that it has, that for a human being to evolve like this, they estimate would take many, many tens of times of years to evolve than what the Earth has been here for. And even then, if it's just pure chance, what is by pure chance would ever come about the evolution of these marvelous species, including mankind, as well as animal kind, as well as the wonderful intricacies that we see within trees and shrubs and all the way down throughout the Earth's history. And it's inconceivable, really, that random chance would produce the kind of beauty, the kind of harmony, the kinds of things that we see all about us every single day. And so we know, through, if nothing else, just through inference, through the wonderful intelligence that we see throughout nature, there is a guiding hand. There cannot not be one. And anyone who is not emotionally charged around this can set aside their biases, and they would have to admit there's something mysterious here. There's something of a wonderful intelligence beyond pure chance or randomness. Now, what Master is speaking of here is that in this creation, there are higher level beings, you might say, those who have higher intelligence, and they help to govern, they help in the evolution of this wonderful creation that we see about us. There was a television show called Touched by an Angel. And there they show these angelic beings who were actively interested in the evolution of humankind. And they couldn't step in and do it for people, but they would help to try to inspire them. They would help to mold things in a way that it worked out for a better end. And this is reflective of a great truth. There are angels. And there are angels who are helping with the evolution and the individuality of human beings as they try to discover, and particularly through prayer. When people pray, they start to draw to themselves hidden, unseen forces. And some of these forces are angelic kind of beings that then are actively involved with that one's life. And there are many people, because they can relate to an angelic being as being kind of a very, very nice human being, and they can relate to that. And so that becomes kind of the be-all, end-all. Everything is about angels. Everything are about these divas. Everything is about the government. There are some people who get very, very involved and thinking about the unseen beings. They're involved in the government of the Earth or the solar system or of larger stellar systems. And it is true that there are these kinds of levels of beings, and it is their job. It is their work within this creation to be able to help in these evolutionary forces. And they are tremendous beings, tremendous beings. But what they don't see is that beyond that, that humankind within their own beings have open access to going beyond angels, going beyond devas, those higher beings, astral beings, sometimes causal beings that are helping this world to come into evolution. And as Mother used to say, that rather than going to Mr. In-Between, go directly to the President of the Universe. And she constantly made this point. It's not to say that these other beings are not true, are not real, do not have an active role in things. And it's not to say that you should not give them due homage in the sense that they are tremendous beings of intelligence, of wisdom, of life, and that they are actively helping in the positive evolution. Now, there are also dark beings on those levels, and they are looking to take advantage. They are looking, they love the energy that's created around chaos. They love the energy that is created around war and violence and that kind of thing, and they feed off of that. You see within a theater of war, and you will see very, very high, noble beings who are practicing restraint, who are trying to be virtuous even in the field of destruction. And you can imagine how difficult that is when adrenaline is running, when perhaps hatred is being focused on you from the other side, and can you remain pure and of a higher nature even in such a field? And what Krishna assures us is that, yes, not only can that happen, but that is the highest virtuous kinds of actions that you can do in this world. Now, there are some who are completely adhere to nonviolence. Gandhi was of such a one. But in this kind of thought, Papa and Master and Mother differed from Gandhi. And although Master clearly held out that there are higher and better ways, as do all spiritual masters, nobody wants to see violence in this world. But try to take away all the policemen in this world without some threat of coercion and violence done in a righteous way. And the kind of chaos, the kind of people who would act as predators without restraint, without any fear, it would be really quite something of a destructive nature. And good people would be silenced into inaction. So in the current day of this age, we need to have those, particularly those of highest virtue, of highest consciousness, of highest aspiration, who are willing and able, and it is their dharma, to do that kind of duty. And when you do it without any selfishness, when you do it without anger or hatred, then you are actually helping in the evolution of your own individuality, but of the world itself. So there are times when people have to stand up and stand against that which is dark, that which is evil. Now, this is a very, very fine line between that and acting out of anger, acting out of ignorance, acting out of a sense for domination. And that is what people are concerned about, and rightfully so. We should be held, everybody should be held, to the highest standards in this regard. But can it be done? And the answer is yes. And should it be done? And the answer is definitely yes. We will come to an age, we will come to a time when such things will be looked upon as such things as war, such things as wanton violence, will be looked upon as an oddity of the past and a kind of insanity and craziness. And indeed it is. Indeed it is. It's very difficult when there are those who are of higher evolution, higher intelligence, to encounter the kinds of things that happen in this earthly realm. And because we come from an astral realm or a causal realm where there is not the intermixing of the good and the bad as there is here on the earth plane, that there can be a Gandhi or a Yogananda and a Hitler on the earth at the same time, is really quite something. It's from the very highest to the very lowest. And so it's only here on this earth plane that that kind of mixture happens. When you're in the astral realms, you resonate with a certain vibration, and that takes you to a certain astral realm or planet. And you only mix with kindred spirits. You only mix with those people who exist on that vibration. And if you are of a lower vibration, or one of darkness and anger and hatred, you automatically, just like a worm, lives in the earth and would be uncomfortable out in the air and the sun, in fact would die there. Even as such, an evil spirit will go into the regions of darkness and cannot go into the regions of light. It just doesn't happen. It cannot happen. Now, a being who is of higher development can, if they choose to, for special purposes, go down into the lower regions, the regions of darkness. But it is difficult for them. And so here on the earth plane, you see a mixture of absolutely every height and lowness of spiritual vibrancy and of consciousness. And that is why we need to be able to protect ourselves physically, protect ourselves psychically, protect ourselves spiritually. And it's not an easy thing being born into this age at this time and really aspire to the higher spiritual life. In many ways, we are not supported in that. You look at advertising, you look at television, you look at the way that people think, the way that people will deride somebody who is trying to live a life of a higher consciousness, of a higher standard. And if you fall short in any kind of way at all, you're completely derided as being a hypocrite. Now, to some degree, that is true, and you are being hypocritical in the sense that you are aspiring for a higher consciousness, for a higher life, and yet you fall short of it. But this kind of derision isn't out of discriminative kind of intelligence or wisdom. This kind of derision comes as, why do you aspire for something higher? And then you don't demonstrate it. Then you fall lower and you are not completely there, as if no one can do it. And I'm here as the hypocrisy police to make sure that, I point out those errors. And it's really done in a negative kind of sense. It's not done in a positive sense. It's not done as a way of helping your brother or your sister to lift up and rise higher. It's a derogatory thing, and therefore of a negative spiritual charge. So we have to be careful of that tendency in our own mind, that both for ourselves, that we do hold ourselves to a higher standard, and that we strive for that. But we also understand in the nature of things that there are times when we may not live up to that. And the main thing here is, once you get a hold of the situation, you get right back on the horse and you begin to ride, as the saying goes. You get right back on and you strive some more. You go with redoubled effort, redoubled determination. You learn your lesson. You see where the mind was drawn towards something negative, something lower. And you see how that began in you. And perhaps in the beginning, you thought, well, I can master this. I'm above it all. And I can delve into this. I can dabble in this a little bit and not get caught. And then suddenly you are caught and you are brought down into that lower realm. And when that happens, you are then really stuck. You're really stuck in the sense that you had no idea how powerful it would be when you get caught up into that realm. And we've seen that with many people. We've seen it with leaders. We've seen it with friends of ours. We see it all over the place. It was a very interesting and sometimes shocking thing to see what would happen with those who followed with Mother. And people who are of very high spiritual nature, there is no doubt of it. And sometimes getting caught up in cocaine, of sex, of all kinds of things that took them down some very dark roads. and a betrayal of their marriage vows, and going even into really the dark regions of sexuality. And so it's really kind of a leveling experience. You really see this is a human drama, and there are those who want to live up to something higher, and yet it just is something that they really, really struggle with. Now, we all struggle. We all struggle. And we really try to live up to a higher standard. And this is very, very important. And when we pray, we can pray to angelic beings if it has a better fit for us or if we can relate to that more easily. Sri Yukteswar said a very interesting thing. He said that when there are those beings who are ready to ascend from the higher spiritual heavens, you see, he's not serving just on an ordinary astral planet, but it would be considered a heaven where he's at to most astral beings. It's a higher level of the astral. And he's helping beings there in their evolution because he's established himself completely in his oneness with God. He can serve on a causal level, an astral level, or the physical level. And God chose for him this higher astral planet. But he said that when people are ready to leave that planet, what we would call death, they treat as a celebration. It's like a graduation party. And that God, in his wonderful kind of sense of play, will show up in whatever favorite forms that individual has of God. So from what we know, it could be Jesus, it could be Master, it could be Hanuman, it could be Rama, it could be any of the great spiritual beings that we feel especially close to. And in this sense, God delights in his play. He delights that he can assume any of these forms that are particularly of touching nature to that individual or that they've been inspired by. And so these forms can take on a wonderful relationship. When I think of Hanuman, I think of the pure devotion that he had to Ram. Now, whether Hanuman ever existed or not in a literal sense has little to do with the spiritual kind of connotations and relationship that you can develop with such a one. And when I think of this form and I think of the stories and the delightful stories that are around him, I feel in my own heart, and Hanuman is the son of the wind god. This means he's the fourth chakra. He's there at the heart center where the wind or the breath comes into the body. And it's there in the heart center. And how does he derive his strength? By thinking on Ram, by thinking of God. And his complete and total devotion to that wonderful God being. And so Hanuman represents this. He represents that strength in your heart. He represents the power of love and devotion there. And when love and devotion are there, the power for overcoming, the power to overcome whatever the odds are, whatever is going on in your outer life, these things begin to pale into insignificance as you feel the strength, the power of that love growing in your heart, that devotion growing in your heart. And so it is said that wherever there is the chanting of Ram's name, you will find Hanuman there. Because he's attracted like a magnet. He can't keep himself away. And you can say this is perhaps true on the outer sense, and it's definitely true on the inner sense, because when you chant that name with love and devotion, you awaken the power of that intelligence right within your own heart. Now, I said that Papa was a human manifestation of Hanuman, and indeed that has to be true. Now, there are those who are the literalists, and they will say, well, is he literally the incarnation? This is not nearly so interesting to me as that he takes on the qualities of Hanuman. He has become the embodiment of everything that is thought of as Hanuman. And so this is really the essence of it. One time Master said that Babaji was Krishna and that he, Yogananda, was Arjuna. And there are those who become very almost obsessed with the idea, oh, well, this is a great historical fact. Arjuna has reincarnated as Master and Krishna has incarnated as Babaji. Well, as Mother said, Master oftentimes spoke in metaphor. And did he mean that there was a historical fact to this? Perhaps, perhaps. But even more meaningfully, there is a deep metaphysical aspect and relationship to this. Arjuna is the perfect disciple in that moment on the Battle of Kurukshetra. He is really up against it. He is in the midst of this battle. And he's really questioning whether this is the right thing for him to do. And he's really battling inside of himself. So he has these dual forces going. He knows that it's his dharma, that it is duty to be there. But he is also feeling a tremendous struggle. And he's thinking, perhaps it's better for me just to retire from this world. Now, has anybody ever felt that way? And, I don't think there's anybody here who hasn't. I'd rather just leave the field of battle. I'd just like to leave this all behind. It's stressful. It's difficult. I'm not even sure if I'm doing the right thing. And maybe it'd be better just to retire from this world and get away from it. And so Arjuna is in this quandary, and he turns himself to Krishna. Now, Arjuna represents the third chakra. And that is the place of individual will. He is the warrior. He's the kshatriya. And it is there from the heart, from this third chakra, from this, just right down in your belly button region. And, the martial arts, they use this as the place of power, the place of energy. And it is a place where, and I saw a demonstration of this, where a martial arts master, his disciples ran at him with everything they had in them to attack him. And he would raise his hands and he would push this energy field against them and they would literally go flying through the air as they tried to challenge the master, and he was in complete control of this power center in the third chakra. Well, this represents, when it is completely focused on the higher consciousness, this represents Arjuna. And so you see in the depictions that Arjuna is down on his knee. And Krishna is standing above him, and Krishna is resplendent in this blue color, this dark blue color. And this is the dark blue of Christ's intelligence, and it's beautiful when you close your eyes and you see it. And as I have my eyes closed here, I see this beautiful color, resplendent, and it goes on and on and on forever. It's embedded throughout this creation. And so when you turn your eyes upon that and it reveals itself to you, you see everything that is true in the terms of wisdom of the divine intelligence of God. You get access to that. Swami Vishwananda was one time talking about this, and sometimes people get into debates. Well, how in the world, if you have these two huge armies who are ready to do battle with you, somebody goes out in the middle and they have this couple hour long conversation, that's a little bit inconceivable. And he used as a demonstration, and he went over and it was nighttime and he turned off the lights. And he says, now keep your eyes open. And then he flicked on the lights and he flicked it back off. And he said, when that light came on, could you see the entire room? And people said, yes, they could see the entire room. He said, in just that way, enlightenment can come to you. This whole conversation between Arjuna and Krishna. Because when divine intelligence comes to you through intuitive wisdom, you can get it in a flash. It's whole, it's complete, it's perfect, and the understanding, your ability to grasp it, is complete as well. And as a result of that, you can understand tremendous mysteries in just a flash like that. And it all unfolds before your inner understanding. And the wonderful thing about this kind of revealed wisdom is that it's not just an intellectual idea. It's not something that you consider like an object that you're looking at. Rather, your whole being resonates with the truth of it and with the realization of it. It's as if every cell of your being can see this truth. And not only just see it, but it resonates. It becomes one with this truth. And it becomes such a complete experience for you that it penetrates all the way through your being, and there is just nothing left in you to question or to doubt. Now, one of the most difficult things in the world is as you're ascending up your spinal stairway and you have access to that kind of an experience, but it really does. It comes and it goes like that light getting switched on and then going back off. Now, it's no longer the direct realization of that experience, but you're trying to remember it. It's like coming out of a dream and then trying to remember your dream. And some of the details begin to fade. And some of the clarity that seemed just so childlike and simple when you're in the middle of that experience begins to fade from you. And it's maddening. You don't want it to go away. You want it to stay with you. But you see, you haven't yet earned the ability to continuously reside in that state of intelligence of that Christ blue. So you just get a brief experience in it. And many times, and you will see this, it happens in the scriptures, it happens with people's revelations, they will get something directly from God. And it's wonderful, and it's beautiful, and it's perfect. But then the experience itself begins to recede, and the mind begins to play with it. It tries to fill in the gaps. It says, oh, that beautiful light, that must have been Jesus, or that must have been Krishna, or that must have been Shiva. And that's the only one, and it's based on that own person's predisposition. And suddenly they begin to interpret into that experience all kinds of things that were not originally there. Mother was talking about those beings who have these near-death experiences, and they see this beautiful being of light outside of them. And the being of light is showing and revealing truths about their own life when they're reviewing their life. And many people have ascribed this, that this is some higher soul, that this is some, perhaps it's Christ who came to them, because they have that kind of feeling of reverence. They have that kind of feeling. But she said, you know, the truth of it is, that's your own Christ self. It's your own higher self who's sitting next to you and revealing these things to you. But you see, we're so far from that, it's difficult to accept that could be me in the sense that that's connected with me. It seems like something outside of me. And that's why we see it that way. That's why we receive it that way. And how many people think of God as being a very, very distant kind of subject, out there someplace, invisible, beyond experience. And the only way that we can know of such a God is through the revelation of His Word, through the Bible, through the Scriptures, through these different ways. And it's all because the mind distanced itself. It has not yet come to the point where it can accept that the same Christ consciousness that existed in the man Jesus also exists within me and exists within you and exists within all beings. Now, it is true that in most people, it is a latent ability. It is not yet manifested. But it doesn't mean that it's not absolutely and perfectly available to that one. And so as we rise up through these various evolutionary courses, we've just recently come out of the Kali Yuga. But the yugas are not just descriptions of outer ages. They are descriptions of people. And so you have these four basic ages. You have the Kali Yuga, in which man's mind is wedded perfectly to materialism. What you see is what you get. You only know what you know through the five senses. And this is the Kali Yuga man. And he dwells in spiritual ignorance. He may be a good person. That's all right. But he doesn't think or really contemplate anything beyond this world of five senses. That's it. End of report. And then you enter in the Dwapara and you start to get a more quickening within the consciousness, and suddenly you see that there is this electrical age. The electrical age is of the astral body. And intuition begins to develop. Perhaps you begin to get glimpses or see the aura. of people or of yourself, you begin to enter into everything that is contained within the astral realm. And then you develop a little more and are quickened more, and you enter into the causal, and you see how everything is a manifestation of an idea from God. And it is more rare, and it is more perfect than even the astral manifestation. The astral seems almost like something gross at that point. And you see the beauty in it, but you also see the problems, because sometimes people's auras, you look at them, and they're dirty. It's like a fog of pollution all around the person. There's a dark aura all around them. Now, it's not always that a person is evil or bad in that sense. It can be a very clouded aura due to a deep state of depression and a difficulty that the individual is going through. But you also see people who are filled with the radiant light. They're like a light bulb. And the filament is burning brightly, and they just radiate just the most wonderful, beautiful light of yellow, white light, beautiful blue light. These higher lights, the purple light, comes out of them. And these are wonderful, and they're beautiful to see. And some people just intuitively, they instinctively, they feel it, but they don't necessarily see it. But you know, in the realm of the astral, all the senses are interchangeable. So you can know everything through a felt sense of things. You can see, you can hear, you can feel, you can do everything. You can even taste and smell through the power of feeling. And same thing with hearing. Those who are especially attuned to music and to that kind, they see and feel this universe as a vibration of music. And so they feel the harmony, they feel the attunement through that sense of hearing, and so on it goes throughout all the senses. And so the astral can be sullied, it can be dirty, or it can be higher of a higher nature. In the causal realm, when you see beautiful, perfect thought, it also has a feeling nature to it, but it's much, much more refined than anything on the astral level. And in the causal, there's more expansion of consciousness. In the causal, you can easily stretch yourself out, even beyond this universe, into the wholeness of all creation. And then in pure spirit of God, you go beyond even the Treta Yuga, or the causal, or the magnetic stage. And you go into the pure spirit, you go into the Satya Yuga, the age of gold, the age of light. And here you transcend all thought of separation. You go into the pure union with spiritual consciousness that began the whole thing in the first place. And you have that all within you. And now you look and you can see that even these high soul beings, these devas, are not of the highest nature yet. They're doing their duty. They're doing what God has assigned them to do if they are of the positive nature. And so they are worthy of respect. They are worthy even of adoration. But they are not the highest, so we should not get relegated to these lower forms. You can see how enticing it can be along the way, how interesting it is, and how it's so far beyond what the ordinary mortal is dealing with on this worldly nature. And so you can really kind of think that you've achieved something. But if you get too caught up in these kind of things, they become a retardant to your growth. You don't go the whole way. You don't express your full potential and capacity. And so we should never settle for Mr. In-Between. We should always be striving for something greater, something higher. Now, these truths are reality. They are reality. They are something that we can definitely achieve. And there are times in your own consciousness when you look around and you just don't see it. You may even believe it. You may come to service. You may think along these things, but really, in your mind, you're just not really seeing it. You're not experiencing it. And that doubt can grow in you. And it can just sweep you away back into the current of worldly consciousness. But you know what? It's painful. It's painful to go back into worldly consciousness, to fall asleep to your own path. And when you finally wake up to it, largely due to the pain that you inflict upon yourself, you really regret. Why didn't I keep myself more attuned? Why didn't I stay more focused? But if you let that come as a lesson to you and you redouble your effort, you realize how subtle things get. I remember moving into that causal realm and I saw how subtly thoughts flow through the mind, and suddenly we jump on them just like jumping onto a car or a train, and they carry us off to a destination we never intended. And at first it just seemed like a free ride. Or there's a very subtle place where you get to, where you truly are, you're feeling a state of self-mastery. And there's a delusive force in there that can make you feel like you're above it all. Now, it's not gross egotism in the sense, oh, I'm just above it all. But you kind of feel that way. You kind of feel like, well, I dabbled into this a little bit. It didn't seem to catch me. But that's the place to beware. To beware. Because those subtle thoughts will start to carry you down a different creative track. And it will begin to build a karmic charge on it. And the further you go down that track, the worse it gets. And suddenly, it's like the frog that's been put in the water that's being brought up to a boil very slowly. The frog doesn't even notice it. It just slowly kind of goes to sleep and says, oh, this is some nice bath water to be in. It's not bath water at all. It's going to be a boiling grave. But it doesn't see it, you see. And this is the way that it can happen in the causal realm. So it gets more subtle as we go along. But one thing that comes to you is you see how ultimately responsible you are for every thought, for every desire, for everything that you give power to. Not until you live in God, that is, you live in bliss, you live in light, you live in that divine wisdom, and you are guided by it, and it becomes completely effortless. Are you really there? And when you do that, you find you will not go down these other tracks, but it takes a complete purification of the mind. Now, when I first went to Anandashram, I asked Swamiji, are you completely realized? He said, no. Here's a man, very sincerely, for very many years, been acting in service, been acting and striving toward that one end. Papa himself said it was 10 years after he formed the ashram before he gave up the last vestige of ignorance. He was still angry about the attack that happened to Mataji and himself. So these are not small things that we're talking about here. And the best attitude is to feel that you are an aspirant through and through and through. You are the disciple. You are the one who, you're the devotee who's striving. And you take that attitude until there is just nothing inside of you that can adopt that attitude anymore, until you completely realize your oneness with the divine. And even then, as you come back into being, you may adopt that same attitude, because that is what God has given you to express to this world. Now, my own judgment is that Swamiji has achieved that complete goal now. I don't think that he had when I first met him in 1998, but I do think that he has now. But if you were to ask him today, he would still adopt the attitude of the devotee, of the aspirant. And he does this to humble those who are around him. Because anybody who thinks that they're just going to kind of jump up onto the podium and declare victory, they look at his life and it's not so, you see. You have to compare yourself there. And here's this great, great God man. As far as I'm concerned, the greatest living in the world today. In complete humility, with the attitude of the aspirant. And from that standpoint, and when you see it from that standpoint, it's a wonderful and it's a beautiful thing. He's pointing the way for all the rest of us. Never give up. Never give in. Always continue. Always continue. And strive for that perfection. When he told me that he had not attained the highest, he explained it. He said, Sahaja Samadhi means without effort. Without effort. It's completely natural. And he says, I am not there yet. I am not there yet. So let us not settle for Mr. In-Between. Let us strive for the highest. Let us put our shoulder to the wheel. You know, if you're sailing a boat, there is a perfect kind of arrangement that happens when you get the sail angled in the right direction and you feel a little gust, you feel the push in the boat. You feel it's going forward. Now, if you're getting too strong a winds and you haven't adjusted your sail right, you begin to actually lose speed and you put the boat in danger that it can actually go over if you're not careful. So it's a constant adjustment. And in your own spiritual sadhana, you're constantly adjusting. You don't want too much tension. Master wrote the poem about closing his eyes in meditation and seeing the burning candle and then running after it. And as he ran after it, the candle would recede. The light would recede. It'd get smaller. Oh, it was so maddening to him. So he sat again. He grew quiet. He'd see the light again. Oh, he'd run after it to capture it. You see, that's the human ego. That's the human, I want to capture it. I want to hold it. I want to control it, really. And so, once again, the light disappeared. And finally, he got the lesson. And he sat and he saw the light begin to glow. And he just, with a calm mind, he just put his mind on the light. And the light began to grow and grow and to expand and expand until it completely captured him. He did not capture the light, you see. The light captured him. And Papa used to tell Mother, Mother, do not be like the baby monkey who clings on to the mother as the mother jumps from limb to limb, because oftentimes the monkeys fall all the way to the ground and they get hurt. So be like the baby kitten who sits on the ground and meows for the mother until the mother comes and picks it up by the scruff of its neck and carries it back to home. It's the same principle, you see. Feel and receive God. You can't capture God. You can't hold God. You can't grab on to God. But you can allow God to hold you, to grab on to you, to take you to your spiritual home. You have to have a complete sense of surrender, complete sense of surrender, for that to happen. So you feel that growing light within you. You may see it, you may feel it, you may hear it, because you hear this wonderful sound of Om coming in through the medulla, the back of your head there. And it's a wonderful vibration, it's a wonderful sound. So you can also let your mind and consciousness and receive that. Or you can see the light at the ajna. Or you can feel it in your heart. And then it becomes an all-pervasive feeling, light, and sound. And you let it, you allow it, to lift you up into your heavenly home. You receive it. To all them who received him, gave he power to become sons of God. What is it to become a son of God? It is to become that part and parcel with that light, with that intelligence, with that uplifting power, until there is nothing else in you. You see, then you have been born in spirit. And you are born again, not of flesh, nor of will, but of God. You see? You see these wonderful truths in the Christian Bible, as well as the Hindu scriptures, as well as all the great scriptures in the world. But there are some religions that get very caught up with Mr. In Between. It's very interesting. We have some wonderful pictures of the Buddha here. The Buddha didn't want anybody to get caught up with mystery in between it all. So he just said, forget about God and goddesses and all the rest of that. Go directly for that experience, nirvana. And yet, can you think of anyone who's had more physical representations made of him than the Buddha? There's statues, there's paintings, there's everywhere. Even people who would not consider them religious, some sort of religious, would have a Buddha out in the garden or in their house someplace. And can you imagine his frustration? What was it exactly about that that you didn't understand? So it's, it's you can't avoid it in that sense. You can't avoid it. So we just need to understand it. That when we are feeling an attraction for a particular aspect of God, this is a representation of something much larger. And if it's that being only, then it acts as a closed door. But if we see it as a transcendent, as a doorway into transcendence, then it does become that. It becomes a doorway. It becomes something to focus our mind on. Because in a human sense, we need something. We need an object for this subject, who we are. And so we need that. And so we respect that. We honor it. But we also recognize, even at the time, that this is a limiting aspect. It's just one kind of expression of the divine. And that it represents something much, much more universal and wonderful than what our minds can conceive in that moment. And so we hold that. And we see the potential, or we at least allow for the potential, even when we can't see it. So let us go directly to the president of the universe. It's very easy. We've had a very tumultuous week or couple weeks in the financial markets. And it's easy to get focused on these things and begin to see with fear what's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to the larger world, all of it. See God's hand in it. See this as an expression of His universal and divine play. See His perfection manifesting through everything. Sometimes things need to be broken in order to cast away that which is negative, that which is rotten inside. And Shiva needs to step in with that destructive power and break things into pieces. And it's not comfortable and it's not easy. But you have to do it. You have to do it in order to take away that which is out of harmony. And if it's not done again, it's just like a broken bone that's not healed properly. And then you have to break that arm again, actually, in order to set it correctly. And it keeps happening as long as we fall short of the goal, fall short of that inner perfection. You see, each one of us need to live up to the highest potential. And when we don't, it hurts us individually and it hurts us collectively. So these things happen. And you have to say, in the long run, it's a good thing, because this inharmony's got to be swept away. But it's hard in the meantime. But don't get caught up in the fear. Don't get caught up in the minutiae of what's going on, because just make sure that you're following the highest path that God has given you in this moment. That's it. That's your participation. And then pray for and see the light coming out of all of this, that things are better, that things are stronger, that things are more perfect. And see the leaders not going after just personal kind of gratification, but see them really focused on what is for the highest good of everybody concerned. And see that coming forward. See it coming forward. They need our prayers. These are difficult times for them. They need our prayers. They need our support. All of them do. And so see the best coming out of them. See the divine intelligence operating through them. and let it, even if you don't have specific prescriptions for them, just see the light coming out of them. See them glowing with that light of intelligence, that understanding, striving for a better and more perfect world. And through the power of prayer, through the power of thought, things will get better. Things will get better. But it demands all of us, to be a part of this. And you can do it by living your own perfection within your own life. You know, that's pretty much a full-time job all on its own. So we don't need to get overly concerned about doing somebody else's job for them or criticizing them for it. Just do your job perfectly. And think about and pray for everybody doing their job perfectly. It's not easy to be in some of these positions, and no matter what you do, somebody will find fault and criticism with you. And it really forces you in the long run to find that strength inside of yourself. What's the right thing to do? How am I being guided here? And when leaders really live that way, it's the same with all of us. When we really live that way, life gets better. Life gets better, even if there's some bumps along the road. So let us not forget that and go directly to the President of the Universe. Will you please pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father. Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of
thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He. Keep you ever in His light, ever in His grace. May you keep the door of your heart open.